tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Alright, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. You are tuned in to part 36 of our continuing series on Henry Ford's unabridged four-volume set, The International Jew. I am your host, Ted Midward, and this is RadioAryan.com. On last week's episode, we delved into some of the character and people around Benedict Arnold. In the first half of today's episode, we're going to continue on with that story. The first article of today's episode is entitled, Benedict Arnold and Jewish Aid in Shady Deal. While Benedict Arnold was in Canada, and David Salisbury Franks, the Jew of Montreal and British subject, was serving as quartermaster to the American troops, David Franks of Philadelphia, a member of the same Jewish family and of the same Jewish syndicate of army contractors, was also engaged in an interesting business. It's already been shown that this David Franks, the Philadelphia Jew, had gone part way with the colonists in their protests against British colonial rule. That this was not sincerity on his part, his subsequent actions proved. He first comes into the purview of this narrative in 1775, the year in which Benedict Arnold performed the remarkable feat of marching into Canada, whence he was sending back into the colonies numerous Canadian prisoners. These prisoners were kept in the New England colonies for a time, but were later collected into Pennsylvania, some of them being quartered in the city of Philadelphia. How inspired it is impossible now to tell, but presently a committee of the Continental Congress proposes that Mr. David Franks be commissioned to feed and otherwise care for these British prisoners, and be allowed to sell his bills for as much money as may be necessary for the purpose. Of course, in accepting this proposal, Franks was not only pursuing the course for which he and his numerous relatives had come to America. He was really doing business with and for Moses Franks, the head of the family syndicate in London. Shortly afterward, we read of David under the mouth-filling title of Agent to the Contractors for Victualizing the Troops of the King of Great Britain. And to check him up, a British officer was allowed to pass the lines once a month and spend a few hours with David. That this was a dangerous practice may be deduced from his further story. In the records of the Continental Congress is a request from Franks that he be permitted to go to New York, then the British headquarters. And such was the power of the man that his request was granted on condition that he pledged his word not to give any intelligence to the enemy, and to return to Philadelphia. In January 1778, 6 months before Benedict Arnold took command of Philadelphia, David Franks got himself into trouble. A letter of his was intercepted on its way to England. The letter was intended for Moses Franks, of London, and was concealed under cover of a letter to a captain in a regiment commanded by a British general, who had married Franks's sister. It appears on the record of the American Congress that the contents of the letter manifest a disposition and intentions inimical to the safety and liberty of the United States. Whereupon it was resolved that Major General Arnold be directed to cause the said David Franks forthwith to be arrested and conveyed to the new gaol in this city, Philadelphia, there to be confined until the further order of Congress. Thus Benedict Arnold comes into contact with another member of the Franks family, whose name was to be closely associated with the Great Treason. And now begins a serpentine course of twistings and turnings, which are so delightfully Jewish as to be worth restating, if only to show how true the race remains to its character through the centuries. It is in October, about the 11th day of the month. Franks is imprisoned and remains there a week. Then, by strange reasoning, it is discovered that the United States has no jurisdiction over the charge of treason against the United States, and that the prisoner should be handed over to the Supreme Executive Council of the state of Pennsylvania. It follows that the state of Pennsylvania has nothing to do with the crime of treason against the United States either, and in spite of the contents of the letter and the findings of the congressional committee thereon, David Franks smiles pleasantly and goes free. It was a time, of course, when much money was lent by Jews to public officials. The Jew, Haim Solomon, was credited with having most of the fathers on his books, but he did not charge them interest nor principal. He grew immensely wealthy, however, and was recipient, in lieu of interest and repayment, of many official favors. David Franks, likewise a wealthy man, charged with treason, has his case transferred and finally dismissed. It is a trick not unknown today. The Jewish records give much credit to Mr. Franks for not being daunted by this experience. Whether he is entitled to particular credit for his courage when he was master of so much influence is a matter for the reader to decide, but that he was undaunted his subsequent actions show. He is very soon on the records again with an appeal for permission for his secretary to go again to New York within the British lines. He appeals to the Council of Pennsylvania. The Council refers him to Congress. Congress says it has no objection if the secretary will be governed by General George Washington's orders in the matter. Washington's aide-de-camp gives permission, and the secretary gives sufficient bonds and sets out for New York. Arrived in New York, the secretary discovers that Mr. Frank's presence is necessary and has made all arrangements for his master to go to New York, having even secured British permission to pass the lines. It was made very easy for Congress. It had only to say yes. But this time Congress said no. The former escape of Franks made people aware of an un-American influence at work. After his first arrest, he was regarded as dangerous to the American cause. He apparently succeeds in living well in Philadelphia in spite of his difficulties, living even gaily with the society of the city. Up to this time, David Franks had come into contact with the two principal figures in Arnold's treason. As purveyor to the captured troops, Franks had met and entertained, in 1776, the young and engaging Major André, who in 1780 was to become the tragic victim of Arnold's perfidy. And in 1778, Franks had been the subject of an order of arrest given to General Benedict Arnold. Jacob Mordecai mentions that it was at Mr. Franks' house that he met Major André, then a paroled prisoner, who was passing his idle hours and exercising his talents in the most agreeable ways by taking a miniature likeness of the beautiful Miss Franks. That is an excerpt from the American Jewish Historical Society, Volume 6, page 41. In the meantime, Benedict Arnold was pursuing his career, a career strangely checkered with brilliant bravery and subtle knavery, a career sustained by the confidence of noble friends who believed in Arnold even against himself. Except for this strange power of holding friends in spite of what they knew about him, Arnold's career would have been terminated before it did. The psychic gift of his and the desperate need of the Continental cause for military leaders held him on until his moral turpitude matured for the final collapse. As stated before, there is no intention to minimize Arnold's services to his country, but there is a determination to show what were his associations during the period of his moral decline, and thus fill in the gaps of history and account for the distrust with which the American Congress regarded the young general. David Salisbury Franks, the Montreal Jew, who was an agent of the Franks Army Contractor Syndicate in Canada, came south to the American colonies with Arnold when the American army retreated. In his own account of himself, written in 1789, 8 years after the treason, he makes so little of his association with Arnold that, were it not for the reports of certain court-martials, it would be impossible to determine how close the two men had been. In his record of himself, as preserved in the 10th volume of the American Jewish Historical Society's publications, he admits leaving Canada with the Americans in 1776 and remaining attached to the American army until the surrender of Burgoyne, which occurred late in 1777. He then lightly passes over an important period which saw the command of Philadelphia bestowed on General Arnold. He mentions simply that he was in Arnold's military family at West Point until his desertion, which was in 1780. Reference to the first court-martial of Arnold, in which Colonel David Salisbury Franks was Arnold's chief witness, will show, however, that Franks and Arnold were more closely associated than the former would care to admit after Arnold's name had become anathema. Indeed, as the Jewish Historical Society's note correctly observes, the account of this court-martial is of much interest as it bears directly upon the relations of General Arnold and his aide, Major David S. Franks, before the traitor's final flight in September 1780. There were, in all, 8 charges preferred against Arnold, the second one being in having shut up shops and stores on his arrival in the city of Philadelphia, so as even to prevent officers of the army from purchasing, while he privately made considerable purchases for his own benefit, as is alleged and believed. What follows is a supporting affidavit printed in the style of the original, with emphatic italics added. On the 7th day of May, 1779, before me, Plunkett Fleeson, Esquire, one of the justices, etc., for the city of Philadelphia, comes Colonel John Fitzgerald, late aide-de-camp to His Excellency General Washington, and being duly sworn, according to law, deposeth and saith that on the evening of the day on which the British forces left Philadelphia, he and Major David S. Franks, aide-de-camp to Major General, went to the house of Miss Brackenberry and lodged there that night. And, the next morning, Major Franks, having gone down the stairs, the deponent going into the front room of the house, to view Colonel Jackson's regiment then marching into the city, saw lying in the window 2 open papers, that on casting his eye on one of them, he was surprised it contained instructions to the said Major Franks to purchase European and East Indian goods in the city of Philadelphia to any amount, for the payment of which the writer would furnish Major Franks with the money, and the same paper contained also a strict charge to the said Franks not to make known his most intimate acquaintance that the writer was concerned in the proposed purchase. That these instructions were not signed, but appeared to the deponent to be in the handwriting of Major General Arnold, whether or not there was a date to it, the deponent doth not recollect. That the other paper contained instructions, signed by Major General Arnold, directing Major Franks to purchase for the said General Arnold some necessaries for the use of his table, that the deponent compared the writing of the 2 papers and verily believes that they were both written by Major General Arnold's own hand, and soon afterward, Major Franks came into the room and took the papers away, as the deponent supposes. And further, the deponent saith not. Sworn, John Fitzgerald. That such a charge involved as much as the trial of Major Franks as General Arnold will at once appear. The statements in the charge argue close association between Arnold and Franks. Yet, in Franks' written record of himself in 1789, he passes over this Philadelphia period thus lightly. In 1778, after the evacuation of Philadelphia by the British Army, and on the arrival of Count D'Estaing, I procured letters of recommendation from the Board of War, and joined him off Sandy Hook. I continued with that admiral until he arrived at Rhode Island, where on the failure of the expedition, I returned to Philadelphia, where my military duty called me. No reference here, nor anywhere in his record, to a closeness of bond between the two, which his testimony, now offered from the records, amply proves to have existed. The judge advocate produced Major Franks, the aide-de-camp to Major General, who was sworn. Question. On General Arnold's arrival in Philadelphia, do you know whether himself or any person on his account made any considerable purchases of goods? Answer. I do not. Question. At or before General Arnold's arrival in Philadelphia, did you receive orders from General Arnold to purchase goods, or do you know of General Arnold's having given orders to any other person to make purchases of goods? Answer. I did receive from General Arnold that paper which Colonel Fitzgerald has mentioned in his deposition. There are circumstances leading to it which I must explain. I had, by being in the army, injured my private affairs very considerably, and meant to leave it, if a proper opportunity to enter into business should happen. I had several conversations on the subject with General Arnold, who promised me all the assistance in his power. He was to participate in the profits of the business I was to enter into. At that time, previous to our going to Philadelphia, I had several particular conversations with him and thought that the period in which I might leave the army with honor and enter into business had come. I received at that time, or about that time, I think several days before the enemy evacuated the city, the paper mentioned in Colonel Fitzgerald's deposition that was not signed, as well as the other. Upon our coming into town, we had a variety of military business to do. I did not purchase any goods, neither did I leave the army. That paper was entirely neglected. Neither did I think anything concerning it until I heard of Colonel Fitzgerald's deposition. General Arnold has told me since, which is since I came from Carolina some time in August last, that the reason for his not supporting me in business was, supposing I had left the army, it was incompatible with His Excellency's instructions and the resolution of Congress. This testimony, seemingly straightforward in form, is rather damning to the characters of both the men involved. Arnold, upon taking command of Philadelphia, ordered the stores and shops to be closed and no goods sold. He stopped business outright. It was a most unpopular order because it prevented the merchants profiting by the new order of things, the return of the Americans. The very next day, the closing law is in force. Arnold writes an order to Franks to make large purchases of European and East Indian goods to any amount, and to keep the transaction secret from his most intimate acquaintance. That is, Benedict Arnold and the Jewish major on his staff have an understanding that under cover of military closing, they will loot the city of its most profitable goods at the enforced low selling prices for the obvious purpose of selling at higher prices when the military order was rescinded. These are undisputed facts. Colonel Fitzgerald saw the papers and knew the unsigned one to be in Arnold's handwriting, even as the signed one was. They were both addressed to the Jewish Major Franks. In his testimony, Major Franks admits the existence of the unsigned order as Colonel Fitzgerald saw it, and admits also to its character. Even Benedict Arnold admitted the order, but he endeavored to show that having exhibited General Washington's orders to him, that being Arnold, to command Philadelphia, that fact would be a sufficient countermand to the orders given to Franks to load up on valuable goods. General Arnold to Major Franks, did you not suppose my showing you the instructions from General Washington to me, previous to your going into the city, a sufficient countermand of the order I had given you to purchase goods? Major Franks, I did not form any supposition on the subject. These are excerpts from records. This admission that he wrote the order and the fact that no large purchases of goods could be shown constituted Arnold's defense. It requires no keen legal mind to show its weakness. If the order was countermanded several days before they entered the city, what was it doing in Miss Brackenberry's house in Philadelphia on the first morning of Arnold's command and the first morning of the operation of his order to close the stores? And why did Franks come in search of it? Discarded orders are not thus carried around and preserved. Probably no purchases were made. Probably the order was not carried out. When Colonel Fitzgerald walked into the room early in the morning and saw the papers, and when soon thereafter Major Franks walked into the room and saw both Colonel Fitzgerald and the papers, there was nothing else to do than to call the plan off. It had become known. Colonel Fitzgerald waited in the room to see what became of the papers. He saw the Jew Franks come and get them. He saw him go out with them. He knew what those papers directed the Jew to do, and he knew that the directing hand was Benedict Arnold's. Doubtless, with this clue, he kept his eyes open in Philadelphia during the operation of the closing order. And doubtless, Franks lost no time in transmitting to General Arnold the fact that he found Colonel Fitzgerald in the room where the papers had been left. The inadvertent visit of Colonel Fitzgerald is the key fact in that phase of the matter. But the Jewish major becomes talkative in his effort to explain the situation. "There are circumstances which I must explain," he says. And then, in words that were frequently in the mouth of Arnold, he represents that his service in the army was injuring his private affairs very seriously, and that he was contemplating retiring from the army and going into business. It's worth noting at this point that numerous opportunities were given Franks to retire, both before and after the Arnold treason, but he developed into a persistent clamorer after official jobs. In spite of his testimony, he could not be shaken loose from public employment. And then Franks revealed the whole secret of his relations with Arnold. They were in close association in profiteering matters. "I had several conversations on the subject with General Arnold. He was to participate in the profits of the business I was to enter into." Arnold was to remain a general in the army. His aide was to get out of the army and to work with him privately, sharing the profits. But what had all this to do with the orders to close the stores at Philadelphia? What had this to do with the papers found by Colonel Fitzgerald? For, after all, this was the circumstance which Major Franks had set out to explain. At last he reaches it. "At that time, previous to our going into Philadelphia, I had several particular conversations with him. I received at that time, or about that time, the paper mentioned in Colonel Fitzgerald's deposition, which was not signed, as well as the other." The paper authorized him to get the most merchantable goods out of the closed stores. It followed upon several particular conversations about the business of which Arnold was to participate in the profits. But apparently, the deal did not go through. Colonel Fitzgerald's untimely appearance and the carelessness of someone in leaving papers about were most unfavorable to the Arnold Franks project. There can be no question of the intimacy of the relations. There can be no question of the intimacy of the relations between the Jew and Arnold and the use that both made of their relationship. There can be no question either that these relationships must have been the result of continuous acquaintance and testing. Merely to show that a Jew once crossed the path of Benedict Arnold and was implicated with him in a discreditable scheme that probably did not fully mature means nothing. But that this Jew was involved in Arnold's fortunes from the time the two first met in Canada until the day that Arnold betrayed his country may mean something. And that is the case. From the time of their first meeting, their lines run along together, Franks always being relied upon by Arnold as the credible witness who extricates him from his scrapes, and Franks usually doing it with a sort of clumsy success, as in the instance just cited. The reader may refer now to the reference made above to Franks' record of himself, in which he mentions having joined Count D'Estaing, the French admiral, at Sandy Hook. This was just a month after Arnold took command at Philadelphia, just a month after the events on which the above charge was based. Evidently, Franks got out of town for a little while. He would notice the coolness of his fellow officers, among whom reports of Colonel Fitzgerald's discovery must have circulated. There would be no prejudice against him because he was a Jew. It would be solely due to the suspicions concerning him. Indeed, readers of the ordinary history will never learn that Arnold had Jews around him. There were David Franks, moneyed man and merchant in the city, and David Salisbury Franks on Arnold's staff, both outstanding figures, yet wholly passed over by the historians, with one or two exceptions, and even these have never caught the Jewish clue. In that day, there was no prejudice against Jews as Jews, even as there is none now. Franks then easily gains letters which permit him to join the French fleet of D'Estaing within a month after the Philadelphia business. And, strange to relate, at precisely the same time, Benedict Arnold conceived the notion that he, too, should go into the Navy, and a month after his appointment to Philadelphia, he writes to General Washington suggesting nothing less that he be given command of the American Navy, at precisely the time Major Franks takes to the water. Here's an excerpt. "Being obliged entirely to neglect my private affairs since I have been in the service," Arnold writes to General Washington, "has induced me to wish to retire from public business, unless an offer, which my friends have mentioned, should be made to me of command of the Navy. I must beg leave to request your sentiments respecting a command in the Navy." So far as the historians have been able to discover, no one ever proposed such a thing as making Arnold the admiral of the American Navy. But then, the historians did not know David S. Franks. He, a landsman, had gone for a few weeks with the French ships. Perhaps he was the friend who mentioned the matter. At any rate, when Franks came off the ships again, it was to serve as witness once more for Benedict Arnold. The charges against Arnold were such as these: permitting an enemy ship to land and buying a share of her cargo, imposing menial service on soldiers, a charge which brought about by an action of Major Franks, issuing passes unlawfully, The case in point being that of a Jewess named Levy, the use of army wagons for his private affairs, and so forth. This is Major Frank's testimony concerning Arnold's permitting the Charming Nancy to land at a United States port, contrary to law. Question by the court. Do you know whether General Arnold purchased any part of the Charming Nancy or her cargo? Answer. I do not know of my own knowledge, but I have heard General Arnold say he did, and I have also heard Mr. Seagrove say he did. Question. Was it previous or subsequent to General Arnold's granting the pass? Answer. It was subsequent. Here is a complete admission of all the facts, but the defense consisted in laboriously showing, by means of quite leading questions addressed to Franks, that the owners of the Charming Nancy were indeed good Americans, though residing and doing business in enemy territory. Franks was rather useful in this part of the business. In the court, overlooking the other elements, simply found that the permission which Arnold gave to the Charming Nancy was illegal. The fact that a major general of the United States Army speculated in the cargo of the ship, which had come into port in violation of the law and on his military permission, was not considered at all. Neither was the fact, stated in the charge, that he gave permission while he was in camp with General Washington at Valley Forge, whom he did not consult in any way. But here again the fact is established that Major Franks was privy to the whole matter, and was the chief witness for Arnold's defense. If it had occurred but once, as at Montreal, that Arnold had been charged with irregularities involving profitable goods, or if it had occurred but once, as at Philadelphia, that Major Franks happened to be the chief available witness, no serious notice could be taken of it. But time and again Arnold is caught in shady acts involving profitable goods, and time and again the Jewish Major Franks is his accomplice and chief witness. And this partnership in shady transactions, extending from the time Arnold first met Franks till the time Arnold betrayed his country, is significant, at least as a contribution to history, and possibly as a sidelight on the gradual degeneration of Benedict Arnold. Arnold could no longer wholly escape, but still the good fortune that seemed patiently to accompany him, as if waiting for his better nature to recover from some dark spell, remained with him, and the court could not exonerate him entirely, but neither could they punish him as he deserved. And so it was given as a verdict that General Arnold should be reprimanded by General Washington, his best friend. Washington's reprimand is one of the finest utterances in human record. It would have saved a man in whom a shred of moral determination remained. Here it is quoted. Our profession is the chastest of all. Even the shadow of a fault tarnishes the luster of our finest achievements. The least inadvertence may rob us of the public favor, so hard to be acquired. I reprimand you for having forgotten that in proportion as you have rendered yourself formidable to our enemies, you should have been guarded and temperate in your deportment toward your fellow citizens. Exhibit anew those noble qualities which have placed you on the list of our most valued commanders. I will myself furnish you, as far as it may be in my power, with opportunities of regaining the esteem of your country. It was a bad day for Benedict Arnold when he got into touch with the Jewish syndicate of army contractors. There was hope for him even yet, if he would cast off the evil spell. But time pressed. Events were culminating. The alien, having gripped him, was about to make the best of the baleful opportunity. The closing chapter was about to be written in glory or in shame. That's the end of the first half of today's episode. This article was written October 15th, 1921. All right, let's move on to the second half of today's episode. The next article is entitled, Benedict Arnold and His Jewish Aides at West Point. After General George Washington had delivered the reprimand to Benedict Arnold, he proceeded at once to make good the intimation which he had given the unhappy officer, saying, I myself will furnish you, as far as you may be in my power, with opportunities of regaining the esteem of your country. It was in late July, 1780, that George Washington had learned of the British plan to march to Newport and attack the reinforcements of the American cause before they could land and entrench themselves. Washington therefore decided to harry the British and perhaps prevent the attack by crossing the Hudson and marching down the East Shore to menace New York, the British headquarters. It was the last day of July, and General Washington was personally seeing the last division over at King's Ferry when Benedict Arnold appeared. It is true that he had been wounded. It is also true that his accounts had not been allowed by Congress. But his wound was the fortune of the war, and the delay in allowing his accounts was due to his already acquired reputation for shady dealing in money matters, neither of which justified him in betraying his country, but both of which might have stimulated him to recover the status he had so early lost. It was thus that Benedict Arnold appeared before George Washington that last day of July, 1780, a man whom Congress rightly distrusted, a man who had been rightly reprimanded, a man whose fellow officers looked at him askance. Yet it was to such a man that Washington made good his word. The army was on the way to New York to attack the British. As Arnold rode up, General Washington said to him, "You are to command the left wing, the post of honor." Those who were present report that, at Washington's words, Arnold's countenance fell. The magnanimity of the first American meant nothing to him. The opportunity to retrieve his good name had somehow lost its value. So patent was Arnold's disappointment that Washington asked him to ride to headquarters and await him there. At headquarters, Arnold disclosed to Washington's aide, Colonel Tighman, that his desire was not for a command in the army, but for the command of West Point. West Point was then but a post up the Hudson River, far outside the zone of important fighting, and certainly the last place it was thought the intrepid Arnold would desire to be. The inconsistency between Arnold's desire for action and West Point's lack of action struck General George Washington very forcibly. He had offered Arnold a chance to rehabilitate his reputation. Arnold hung back, asking for a place where no distinctive service could then be rendered. Now let the reader take note of this fact. It may be important, it may be unimportant. It may have some bearing on Benedict Arnold's action, it may have none. But the fact, nevertheless, is this. The forage master, that is, the quartermaster at West Point, was Colonel Isaac Franks, a member of the same family which we have been considering in these articles. This Colonel Isaac Franks, we're informed by the Jewish records, which make a great deal of the fact, was once confidential aide-de-camp to General Washington, though for what reason the relationship was dissolved, we are not informed. The reader will recall that the narrative of Benedict Arnold has already included two members of the Franks family, David of Philadelphia and David Salisbury Franks, who came down from Montreal. The third Franks is now in view, Colonel Isaac Franks. He is in charge of supplies at the post of West Point. It is to West Point that Benedict Arnold wishes to go, even though General Washington is offering him the post of honor in the forward movement which the Continental Army is about to make. It is the last day of July, 1780. On August 3rd, General Washington gave Arnold his orders and allowed him to proceed to take command of West Point. Accompanying him, of course, was Colonel David Salisbury Franks, his aide-de-camp, whose testimony had been so useful at the court-martial. There were then two Franks at West Point, Colonel D.S. Franks, aide to the commandant, and Colonel Isaac Franks, in charge of supplying the post. It appears that Arnold had already been in communication with the enemy and had asked for command at West Point, not for any of the reasons he alleged to General Washington, but because he had already chosen it as the gateway through which he was to let the British through into the weakened American territory. For 2 months, Arnold had been writing to Anderson, or John Andre. He had been reaching out toward the enemy for a longer time than that and had at length requested that a man equal to himself be appointed to negotiate with him. Major John Andre, Adjutant General of the British Army in America, was chosen as one of rank sufficiently high enough to deal with Arnold. They had already come into touch with each other before Arnold asked General Washington for the post at West Point. And Andre, as we have previously seen, knew the Franks. Apologists for Arnold have said that the reason he showed so deep a disappointment when General Washington offered him the command of the left wing of the army was that he had never expected such magnanimous treatment and for the moment was conscience-stricken that he had gone so far with the enemy when his own country offered him such fine prospects. If that were the true state of Arnold's mind, he need only have taken command of the left wing, or, having been committed to take West Point, he needed only have gone there and performed his soldierly duty. The history and personality of Major John Andre, who completed the negotiations with Arnold and lost his life as a spy, while Arnold lived long as a traitor, have been the object of much interest and research. His descent is obscure. His parentage was known as Swiss-French. It is thought that the first Andre came to England in the train of a Jewish family. Andre himself had those accomplishments which were most highly prized in the society of the day. In any event, of Jewish or of non-Jewish descent, he was a far finer character than Benedict Arnold. On Arnold's staff at West Point, besides the two Jewish Franks, Isaac and David, there was Lieutenant Colonel Richard Varick. This Varick was a young, wise fellow who preferred to have as little as possible to do with Arnold's affairs. He refused to take any responsibility connected with Arnold's dealings with money or goods. For some apparently good reason, which will not be difficult for the reader to surmise, Varick adopted the strict policy of keeping his hands off all supplies. Thus, it was left to Major Franks to attend all such matters, to which he was apparently nothing loath. In fact, Major Franks even looked after General Arnold's private cupboard. Not to delay longer over details, suffice it to say that on September 22, 1780, less than 2 months after assuming command at West Point, the treason of Benedict Arnold was accomplished. One more day, and it was discovered and foiled. Instant inquiry was made to detect accomplices. Major Franks is placed under arrest. David Franks of Philadelphia is arrested. It may or may not be significant, but it is nevertheless a fact that, upon the accomplishment of Arnold's treason, the authorities ordered that the two Jews, David Franks and David Salisbury Franks, be put under arrest. The experience of David Franks adds a bit of Jewish comedy to this serious scene. It appears that he still has influence to save him from severe treatment and to gain him time. On the occasion of his previous arrest in 1778, Benedict Arnold was commander of the city of Philadelphia, and David Salisbury Franks was on Arnold's staff, and if Arnold and Franks could concoct a scheme of profiteering off all the closed stores of the city, it was probably not beyond them to see that the elder David Franks received favor in his case. At least, as the reader of previous articles knows, David Franks went free, although caught in the act of communicating with the enemy. But this time, there is no Benedict Arnold to help him, and his nephew, like himself, is under arrest because of Arnold's treason. Yet, the Philadelphia Jew discloses a marvelous facility of playing horse with the law. He remained in jail until October 6th, and then, strange to relate, he is given 2 weeks to get within the enemy's lines. Investigation somehow has been stopped. Prosecution has been sidetracked. But David found 14 days too brief a time to wind up his affairs, and he petitions for an extension of time. It's denied. Then, when 1 week of time had passed, Franks asked for a pass to New York for himself, daughter, manservant, and 2 maidservants. This is refused, and passes are authorized for himself, daughter, and 1 maidservant, provided she be an indented servant. But David does not use these passes. He applies again for an extension of time on account of an indisposition of body. Thus, by keeping officials busy with his evasions and counter-suggestions, the record finds him still in Philadelphia on November 18th, a month after he was supposed to be out of the country. He makes application for another pass. The counsel obediently sends him one, the secretary making this observation in his note. The counsel are much surprised that you still remain in this city, and hope that you will immediately depart this state, agreeable to their late order, otherwise measures will be taken to compel you to comply with the state. Does David go? He does not. He writes an extremely polite letter. Incidentally, he gives a hint of what may be keeping him. In his letter to the council, he says, "Being apprehensive that a report raised and circulated that I had depreciated the currency by purchase of specie may have given rise to prejudice against me with honorable counsel." More than likely, this is precisely what David was doing. It was done later by another Jew in American history, Judah P. Benjamin, and it was done everywhere by Jews during the recent war. With David's racial itch for money and his disloyalty to the American cause, there was probably some sound foundation for the report. And then, in this last line of this letter, he finds fault with his past and asks for another. All this time, of course, he is gaining time and is fulfilling his purpose with regard to the specie. This, by the way, is a common Jewish stratagem. It is very much observed in lawsuits. The non-Jew can always be depended on to desire justice and humanity, and these traits are systematically played upon. The non-Jew is also inclined to take men's word at its face value, which is also a trait which can be used to his hurt. If, for example, in a business transaction which is to be consummated a week hence, the non-Jew could absolutely fortify himself if he had the slightest suspicion of sharp dealing, it is to the advantage of the Jew who tries to do him to give him his word as to exactly what steps will be taken a week hence at the final settlement. If the non-Jew believes that word, he is quieted for a week. He does nothing. He rests implicitly on the given word. Then the morning comes, and the dishonest Jew steps up without warning and drives through ruthlessly to a tricky gain. This is so common that thousands who have been tricked by it have told the full details. Keep the Gentile so busy, or satisfy him so fully, that he will not bother. That's the strategy. David knew it even in his day, and it was ancient then. His request for a new pass is refused, but he still does not go. Finally, an aroused council sends him notice to be gone by the next day, and then he goes, but not, we may well believe, until he had done all he intended to do. David is delightfully Jewish, and the council are naively Gentile. Up at West Point, other matters are proceeding. When General Washington arrived and heard the startling news, he asked Colonel Varick to walk with him. He spoke to the young officer most considerately, told him he did not question his loyalty, but under the circumstances he would ask him to consider himself under arrest. It was very like Washington to do this, to make the arrest himself gently. There is no record, however, that a like courtesy was shown the Jewish major David Salisbury Franks. Washington probably remembered him as the witness for Arnold in the case which led to Arnold's court-martial and reprimand. On that frontier post, as West Point then was, there were no witnesses. Franks and Varick were confronted with the necessity of testifying for each other. That is, the Jewish major was his own representative in court and practically his own witness. Franks put Varick on the stand to testify for him, and Varick put Franks on the stand to testify for him. The resulting testimony shows that Franks knew much and was eager to tell how much he knew of Arnold's traitorous intentions. But he did not tell it until Arnold's treason was exposed and he himself under arrest. The purpose of this article being merely to fill up the gaps which are left in the Jewish propagandist boasting of the part they have played in public affairs in the U.S., the reader must himself be a judge as to how far Major David Salisbury Franks was in Arnold's secret. Note, the Smith mentioned in the testimony here shortly coming was Joshua Het Smith, who did secret work for Arnold and rode Andre ashore for the night conference with Arnold. Following are vital extracts from the testimony. Major Franks. What was my opinion of Joshua H. Smith's character and conduct and of his visits at Arnold's headquarters? Colonel Varick responds, when I first joined Arnold's family, Arnold and yourself thought well of him as a man, but I soon prevailed on you to think him a liar and a rascal, and you ever spoke of him in a manner his real character merited. Arnold, of course, knew what Smith was. Arnold and Smith were already partners in treason, but Varick did not know of this partnership. All that Varick knew was that both Arnold and Franks appeared to hold the same opinion, that Smith was all right. Here, Arnold and Franks appear as agreed again. Varick regarded them as holding the same opinion. Varick says to Frank's face in answer to Frank's question. He does it, however, from a friendly purpose. But the fact is significant that Franks and Arnold are found holding the same front. Namely, that Arnold and yourself thought well of him as a man. Now, Arnold knew what Smith was, knew enough about Smith to hang him. Smith was one of the tools of his long, extended treason. The question is, did Franks also know? Was Franks kept in ignorance of Arnold's real knowledge of Smith, or was Franks actually deceived as regards to Smith? It may be, but let this be observed, that Varick, who was not at all in Arnold's confidence, nevertheless was not deceived about Smith, but saw through him at once. Did not Franks see through him too? Until the time that Varick dared speak out about the matter, Franks and Arnold were preserving the same appearance of opinion. They thought well of him as a man. Then Varick honestly spoke out. He got a hold of the Jewish Franks and told him all that he knew and suspected about Smith. The evidence was too overwhelming for Franks to scoff at. Any man scoffing at Varick's tale would himself be under suspicion. Varick was given to understand that he had changed Franks' opinion of Smith. Thereafter, Franks comported himself in a manner to convince Varick that he regarded Smith as a liar and a rascal. It is permissible to ask, was this pretense or reality? If Varick knew things, Varick was a man to handle wisely. If Varick knew things, it would be foolish to lose touch with him and thus lose the benefit of knowing how much was known or surmised outside. These, of course, are the arguments of suspicion, but they are made concerning the same Jewish officer who, on finding that Colonel Fitzgerald had discovered the profiteering venture in which Franks and Arnold were partners, was wise enough to inform Arnold and permit the plan to drop. Major Frank's previous behavior, like Benedict Arnold's, arouses the suspicion. Benedict Arnold appeared to Varick to regard Smith as a good man. Franks appeared to Varick to share Arnold's opinion. But whether Franks really knew, as Arnold knew, and only pretended to change his opinion that he might keep the confidence of Varick, is a point on which Franks' previous conduct compels the mind to waver. How well Franks knew Arnold may be gathered from other points brought out in this testimony. Major Franks. How often did Arnold go down the river in his barge, whilst I was at Robinson's house? Did I even attend him, and what were our opinions and conduct on his going down and remaining absent the night of the 21st of September, which was the night of him meeting Andre? Colonel Varick answers that Frank, to his knowledge, never accompanied Arnold. But when I was informed by you or Mrs. Arnold on the 21st that he was not to return that evening, I suggested to you that I supposed he had gone to Smith's, and that I considered Arnold's treatment of me in keeping up his connection with Smith in opposition to the warning I had given him as very ungenteel, and that I was resolved to quit his family, meaning his staff. We did thereupon concert the plan of preventing their further intimacy by alarming Mrs. Arnold's fears. You did at the same time inform me that you could not account for his connections with Smith, that you knew him to be an avaricious man and suspected he meant to open trade with some person in New York under sanction of his command, and by means of flags and the unprincipled rascal Smith, and that you were induced to suspect it from the letter he wrote to Anderson in a commercial style as related to you by me. We thereupon pledged to each our word of honor that if our suspicions should prove to be founded in fact, we would instantly quit him. It is the honest Varick talking, Franks questioning him. It will be observed that it is Franks who tells of Varick of Arnold's absence and that he will not return that night. Franks knew, but Varick did not. It will be observed also that it was Varick who protested and threatened to quit Arnold. It was indeed the second time he had threatened to quit, but the Jewish major seems never to have had a similar thought. But most important to observe is Varick's statement in answer to Franks and in Frank's presence that it was Franks who opened up with information regarding Arnold's character. That Arnold was an avaricious man, that Franks suspected him of opening up trade with the enemy under sanction of his command, just as he had planned to misuse his authority at Philadelphia, and that Smith was to be the go-between. Then he mentions a letter to Anderson in a commercial style, this Anderson being none other than Major John Andre of the British Army. Here we find Major Franks intimate with every element of the conspiracy, every element of it, and giving a certain explanation of it to Varick. Did Franks know more than he told, and was he quieting Varick with an explanation which seemed to cover all the facts, and yet did not divulge the truth? It's a question that occurs directly. We recall that the collusion of Arnold and Franks at Philadelphia. There's other testimony that it was Varick, not Franks, who prevented Arnold selling supplies of the government for his own profit. Time and again this occurred, but never with Franks, the longtime aide and confidant of Arnold in the role of actor. But every time Varick did it, Franks knew of it, as he testified. Now we approach the day of his desertion, as the records call the day of Arnold's treason. Major Franks. What was Arnold's, as well as my conduct and deportment on the day of his desertion, and had you the slightest reason to think I had been or was party or privy to any of his villainous practices in correspondence with the enemy or to his flight? Pray relate the whole of our conduct on that day to your knowledge. Colonel Varick responds, saying, I was sick in a greater part of the time in my bed in the morning of his flight. Before breakfast, he came into my room and talked about certain letters, and I never saw him after, but betook myself to my bed. I think it was about an hour thereafter when you came to me and told me Arnold was gone to West Point. Also, a considerable time thereafter, you came to the window of my room near my bed, and shoving it up hastily told me, with a degree of apparent surprise, that you believed Arnold was a villain or rascal, and added you had heard a report that one Anderson was taken as a spy on the lines, and that a militia officer had brought a letter to Arnold, and that he was enjoined secrecy by Arnold. I made some warm reply, but instantly reflecting that I was injuring a gentleman and friend of high reputation in a tender point, I told you it was uncharitable and unwarrantable even to suppose it. You concurred in opinion with me, and I lay down secure in the high idea I entertained of Arnold's integrity and patriotism. Here is a record of Major Frank's conduct, told at his own solicitation before a court of inquiry. It reveals that Arnold told Franks, but did not tell Varick, where he was going. It reveals also that Franks knew of the message that came to Arnold, the bearer of which had been bound by Arnold to secrecy. Here's an author's note. For the reader's benefit, it is recalled that Arnold's treason was prematurely exposed by André being lost in the woods at night after his interview with Arnold and his consequent inability to get back to the British ship. He was sighted and halted in daylight, and discovery was made of the West Point plans in his stockings. The innocent soldiers sent word to Benedict Arnold, their commanding officer, that they had captured a spy named Anderson. This gave Arnold information that the plot had fallen through. Enjoining absolute secrecy on the messenger, Arnold made off hastily, as if to investigate, but really to rush to the ship to which André had failed to return. That's the end of the note, continuing on. But observe, the messenger arrived, and immediately Franks appears to be informed what the message contains. He is informed also that Arnold is going to West Point. He is informed of Arnold's capture. Once again, Franks is in instant touch with all the points of the matter, but this time he goes further and accuses Arnold. In the peculiar phraseology of Varick, which may or may not be significant, Franks hastily told me with a degree of apparent surprise that he believed Arnold to be a villain or a rascal. Then the difference between these two men appeared again. It shines out luminously. When it was possible to save Arnold, it was Varick who was most concerned, while Franks appeared to be hand in glove with the traitor. But when it was apparent that something irrevocable had happened, it was the Jew who was first and bitterest to denounce, while Varick remembered the conduct expected of gentlemen. Likewise, as at first, the Jewish major changed his opinion of Smith to agree with Varick's opinion. So now he concurred in opinion with Varick, although he had just violently uttered the opposite opinion concerning Arnold. Varick was charitable because he did not have the facts. Was Franks outspoken as he was because he had all the facts? If so, where did he get them? From Arnold? How much did Franks know? That question will probably never be answered. There is, however, this additional testimony of his on record. I told you that I thought Arnold had corresponded with Anderson or some such name before from Philadelphia, and had got intelligence of consequence from him. David Salisbury Franks was implicated in every major crime of Benedict Arnold, and in the Great Treason, he gave evidence of knowing every moment of the game. David Salisbury Franks was implicated in every major crime of Benedict Arnold, and in the Great Treason, he gave evidence of knowing every movement of the game, from its far beginning in Philadelphia. Franks was exonerated by the court. From his safe retreat on the British Man of War, Benedict Arnold wrote a letter in which he exculpated Smith, Franks, and Varick, writing that they were totally ignorant of any transactions of mine that they had reason to believe were injurious to the public. Smith was neither ignorant nor innocent. He had rowed out to the British ship and brought Andre ashore for his conference with Arnold. He had been a go-between on many shady missions. Yet Arnold, in his letter, exonerates Smith. That fact seriously affects his exoneration of Franks. If Arnold can lie about Smith's innocence, why cannot he lie about Franks' innocence? As to Varick, he is the only one of the three men who can do without Arnold's exoneration. To Varick, it is an insult to have Benedict Arnold vouch for him. Franks, however, was always afterward inclined to lean upon Arnold's letter. An impartial study of the testimony, upon the background of a knowledge of Frank's history, leaves grave doubts as to the unimpeachability of his relations with Benedict Arnold. So much so, indeed, that in the study of Arnold's treason, it is a grave omission to pass over Frank's name. The reader will make a complete study of Frank's character as revealed in the records, which will testify to this. The present study has been exceedingly charitable to his character. He could easily have been prejudiced in the reader's mind by the presentation of a series of facts omitted here. The object has been to judge him solely on his acts with relation to Benedict Arnold. Rightly or wrongly, Franks was suspected ever afterward. It was the Philadelphia incident that stamped his reputation. The suspicion of perjury on that occasion never left him. Franks insisted on having himself vindicated all around, but he was never satisfied with his vindications. He always wanted more. Jewish propagandists have misrepresented his subsequent work as a diplomat. It was of the merest messenger boy character, and he was entrusted with it only after the most obsequious appeals. He peddled petitions, reciting his services, and asking for government favor. The man who asserted in his defense at Philadelphia that he was eager to leave the army and to enter business, and could not be induced to leave the public service until the allotment to him of 400 acres of land seems to have effectually weaned him from public life. What his end was, no one appears to know. His present-day use, however, is to furnish Jewish and pro-Jewish propagandists with a peg on which to hang extravagant praise of the Jew in revolutionary times. There can be no objection whatever to Jewish propagandists making the most of their material, but there is strong objection to the policy of concealment and misrepresentation. These impositions on public confidence will be exposed as regularly as they occur. That's the end of this article. This was published October 22nd, 1921. And there you have it. More detail about Benedict Arnold and the Jewish merchants in and around him during the war. Now, I will say that it's hard for anyone today in public school. And, of course, you get it in grade school, elementary school. You get some background on the Revolutionary War. But you really don't learn much in high school, that is, from my experience. Or post-high school education, you don't learn all that much about the Founding Fathers and the American War for Independence. Unfortunately, you don't. You hear about Benedict Arnold and his supposed treason, but you really don't drill too deep into it. So most people, even if they are aware of Benedict Arnold and the story around him that he committed treason, they likely don't know the details around it, and they really can't explain the American War for Independence when we separated from Britain. So once again, another story down the rabbit hole of history, down the memory hole, and luckily, Henry and his editors made use to document it and record what was known on the subject and cite some of their sources for it. But that is the end of the story of Benedict Arnold for this series. I believe in the next article we will move on to a different subject. So there you have it, Benedict Arnold and the Jewish connection that was involved in the treason plot. Imagine that. Until next time, guys, take care, praise Christ, God bless, bye-bye.